three men stepped out. Although Smythe had never seen the men before, he quickly identified them from a picture published in Saucer News. They were John Keel, Gray Barker, and James W. Mosley, or so he thought. Smythe, who had observed the men from an upstairs window, ran down the stairs to greet them, only to see their blue Volkswagen speeding away up the street. It bore no license plate. Feeling there had been something strange about the men, he telephoned Mosley and Barker, who told him they had not been away from home all day. He checked again with the picture. Although the men bore facial characteristics identical to the men in the picture, including Keel's then copious beard, Smythe knew there had been something wrong with what he now believed to be an impersonation. Then he remembered, Barker and Keel had been of the same height, that is the impersonators, a while Mosley was the shortest of the group. In reality, the actual order of height in the picture was Barker, Mosley, Keel. Whoever the impersonators had been, they had goofed on heights. A week later, while he was passing a parking lot on his way home from work, three men stepped out of a black Plymouth, of 1960-62 vintage, and which bore West Virginia license plates, strangely distorted, since the West Virginia was printed at the top instead of properly at the bottom, while the numerals, 1436, have since been determined not to exist on such plates without some other type of prefix or designation. The men accosted him as if they knew all about him, even though they asked him if his name was George Smythe. When he replied in the affirmative, they displayed SAUCERS membership cards, as members of Saucer News Operating Organization, bearing the names of Arthur Davidson, Thomas Murphy and Walter Mulberry, or Mulberry. They next asserted that they were well aware of all the events which had happened to Smythe and which he had related to the Saucer News staff. They simply wished him to relate once more the events as they occurred. Smythe then reviewed for them the entire series of strange happenings, while one of the trio wrote in a notebook. Then they urged him to continue to report all future events to Saucer News. Later, when Smythe spoke to Gray Barker by telephone, he learned that neither Barker nor any of the staff had disclosed any of the information to anybody. Our house is watched. During the last week of May, the strange series of events seemed to be drawing closer home, when my wife, Mary, mentioned during a supper conversation that she had noticed some odd people near the house each morning as she went marketing. A large black car was parked near our front door, and a statue-like, tall, corpse-white man with very light hair was always standing beside it. The car, she told me, had bright red upholstery. The tall man, however, had not caused her any alarm. But a dark, swarthy-faced man in a dark or black suit had looked piercingly at her as she emerged from the outer door, and then had peered into the vestibule, as if to determine if anyone else were coming out. Since this had occurred on four successive days, it was getting on her nerves. She had hesitated to mention it, she told me, for fear I would think she was imagining things, and assured me that she actually had seen the men. I pondered on this, for I knew that when I left work at 8 o'clock each morning, I had seen nobody on the street. Whoever the men were, they were avoiding me and showing up half an hour later, when Mary went shopping. Why did they not try to frighten me? For I had been involved with the Saucer News investigation of the experiences of Smythe, and other strange events. Suddenly I remembered that James W. Mosley's name was on my mailbox. He did this so that he could receive mail from certain confidential sources at our address, and then he often stayed for several days at a time at our house when engaged on research projects which involved much reading and concentration. Thus he would avoid telephone calls and the many personal visits by friends and people interested in interviewing him. Could it be that the visitors were checking up on Jim and were relatively disinterested in Mary and me? I immediately phoned Jim and told him about the men, though noises on the line led me to believe the line was being tapped. Jim told me to instruct Mary to secure license number of the car, should she see it again, and suggested I familiarize her with the Cadillac emblem so that she might recognize it. Both Jim and I knew that most of the men in black reports included a large car, usually a Cadillac. The phone call evidently set off another series of happenings which are difficult to or impossibly for me to evaluate. Next morning when Mary went to shop, nobody stood at the factory entrance as usual, nor did a large black car with a pale-faced individual occupy its usual position. However, as she returned home, she noticed Jim Moseley standing in the middle of the nearby street acting almost, it seemed, like a traffic policeman. She stood and watched him for perhaps 3 to 4 minutes, while he turned and looked in all directions, apparently without noticing or recognizing her. Mary had the impression that he was attempting to see what would happen if he exposed himself, and that he evidently did not wish her to approach him. So she entered the house. She gave it little further thought, except for thinking that it was a very early hour for Jim, who usually arose about noon, to be in Jersey City. Jim at that time lived in Manhattan and the trip to Jersey City would have consumed about 45 minutes. A grocery item she had forgotten to purchase made it necessary for her to return to the market, so she went out again. Jim was still standing in the same position, still looking in all directions and not appearing to notice her. She observed that while he was dressed in the usual business suit, he was also wearing the great top coat he had worn the past winter. She knew that I had gone to work dressed only in a business suit, and that I had remarked how warm the morning was. In fact, the top coat was the only circumstance which really struck her as odd about his being at the intersection. She went to the store, and when she returned, she again stood and watched Jim at his station. Then she entered the house and proceeded to clear the breakfast table, with the thought that Jim probably would ring the bell, have a cup of coffee and a chat before he returned to New York. She also again wondered how Jim had managed to get up so early, for he liked to do his UFO research late at night, and into the early morning hours, away from the pressures of his office and the many telephone calls. In about 10 minutes the phone rang and it was Jim on the line. He explained he was still in bed, but has awakened and was wondering about the MIB situation. He had an impulse to call her briefly before going back to sleep. He asked her if she had looked outside yet to see if the man were still there. Without explanation, she asked Jim to hold the phone. Then she ran outside. Our windows do not overlook the street. Jim, or the man who had looked exactly like him, was no longer there, and, for the first time, this was very upsetting to my wife. She wondered if she were imagining things, due to her worrying about the visitors. She ran back into the house, and tried to explain what she had seen to Jim, though by that time she had become quite shaken. Although he couldn't quite understand just what she had seen, Jim advised her either to stay in the house, or dash over to her neighbor's house and stay with her until I returned that evening. When I returned, I found a very frightened wife, who by that time had regained her composure and was able to give me all the details in a coherent manner. I called Jim, and although I kidded him about Mary's seeing his doppelganger, I secretly wished that I were able to get my hands on the impersonator. Later that night I called Gray Barker and gave him all the details, and he tended to connect it with the Smythe report of the impersonations described above. Days passed without further incident. Mary, however, had begun to leave the house the same time as I did on weekdays, and would visit various neighbors while I was away. On Saturday, May 18, Jim called to make arrangements for Timothy Green Beckley and himself to visit us and make copies of some of my many tape recordings. It was agreed that they would arrive early, for Jim, at 10 o'clock the next morning. As they approached my house, they observed a black Cadillac parked in front of the closed factory next door. They decided not to stop, but to drive around the block and make some passes in front of the house, to observe and take pictures. Jim had thoughtfully brought his camera. They also noted the swarthy man Mary had described, standing in the factory entrance. They managed to make only 2 passes and to secure 2 pictures accompanying this article, before the man evidently fled. On the third circuit of the house both he and the Cadillac were gone. Mary had identified the man in the photograph as the same person who had looked at her so piercingly on those 5 mornings. At this writing, July 1, there has been no repetition of any of the visitations. Yet, On June 11, George Smythe had called me with a report which seemed to tie in with Mary's experiences. He asked me what I thought Jim had been doing in Elizabeth that morning, and I replied that he had not been there, for I had just talked to him at his apartment, having awakened him in order to get a telephone number which I urgently needed. Smythe then related what had occurred. He had been on the bus, going to work as usual, and had observed Jim standing in front of the Carteret Hotel in Elizabeth, as he passed there on his usual route. Jim, he said, had smiled and waved at him. Smythe stated that Jim had worn a grey suit, with striped tie and white shirt, Moseley a TMS favourite mode of dress. The only relevant information concerned a trench coat Jim carried on his arm, which Smythe described. Jim has never worn that type of coat, to my knowledge. A day or two after the incident, Smythe began to hear from acquaintances who told him they had been questioned by a very tall, grey-haired man, who also made inquiries about him. All but one of the people had asked the man for identification, whereupon he departed abruptly without further questioning. Those questions by the tall stranger had one thing in common: all were employees or owners of the various eating places Smythe frequented near his place of work. Only one person, the operator of a hot dog stand, had spoken at length with the person. Apparently the tall man already possessed a great deal of information about Smythe. Although the stand operator knew much about Smythe, it seemed he was unable to supply the man with anything he did not already know. During the early evening of June 15, Smythe's phone rang and a cultured voice, as he described it, advised him to stop all saucer research and to discontinue any connections with Barker, Moseley, Beckley, Keel and myself. Further, he should not attend the forthcoming Congress of Scientific Ufologists, later National UFO Conference, in Cleveland. If he did not comply with the requests, he would deeply regret it, the voice warned. Since Smythe does not know Beckley, nor exchange information with him, and since he did not plan to attend the Congress, his caller was evidently partially misinformed. On the 18th, Smythe called to tell me he had been unable to go to work that day, due to a particularly upsetting occurrence. Early in the morning, as he was preparing to leave and catch his bus, his dog had begun howling like a wolf while it looked out the window. Smythe went to the window and looked out. On the other side of the street was a large black car, with one man in the driver's seat, and two people in the rear, both of which were attending some kind of electronic equipment. One of the men apparently wore earphones, while the other raised a contraption which he described as a crystalline wheel, with a 2 to 3 foot rod extending from it. The wheel began to glow with a yellow light, then the light suddenly concentrated into a yellow beam, which shot out, striking Smythe in the forehead, as he felt a blast of heat. Before he blacked out, he was able to note the license plate on the car. It resembled a U.S. government plate, and bore the identification, U1436. The car quickly left after the race struck Smythe. When he recovered consciousness, he was suffering a splitting headache. The headache persisted throughout the day and two more blackouts occurred. They have been in Cleveland, Ohio, during the Cleveland Congress. A rather odd incident occurred in the luncheon room of the Wild Boar Inn, a part of the Sheraton Airport Motor Inn, where most of the attending delegates were lodged. On the afternoon preceding the open session, a group of delegates met to have lunch prior to departure for the Valley Forge High School auditorium where the public lectures would take place. The tables, each seating 4, were occupied by the elite of the Congress, such as Captain Robert Lofton, Moseley, Beckley, Ralph Fanning, Jean Duplantier, and Alan H. Greenfield. Mary and I, along with Barker and Roseanne Maruka, a bibliographer, interested in ufology, who has just completed cataloging the huge UFO publication collection of Moseley and is trying to track down the many items which recently have disappeared. Mary suddenly glanced toward a table, directly behind me, and near the door of the inn. In a voice, which suddenly had been raised, and which startled all of us, she exclaimed, "Concentrate, everybody, we are being watched. Quiet, everybody." We are under surveillance. Barker looked up from his late breakfast to determine what was causing Mary's concern. He said nothing, but just stared past me. As quickly as propriety allowed, I managed to turn my chair and my head to look in that direction. I saw the backs of two male figures, leaving the room in a most precipitate manner. Mary, who had observed the men for some minutes before speaking out, and then, in her fright, had cried out rather loudly, told us that a very pale, blue-eyed man, with silver-colored hair, had been staring at Barker from an uncluttered table near the entrance of the room. He had been dressed in a black turtlenecked sweater, and had been accompanied by another man, in a black suit, and who wore large sunglasses. The latter had not been looking at our group, but when Mary made her exclamation, he appeared to be startled, quickly arose, and beckoned for the silver-haired man to follow him. And that is just about all of it. Barker did call me, immediately after he had returned home from the Congress, noting that he had been unable to evade the constant tailing of a car driven by a dark-clothed priest, which followed him most of the way home from Cleveland. Doppelganger is a German word describing the exact double of an individual. It is not so much associated with the etheric or astral body as it is a kind of physical double. Although this phenomenon is said to occur early, it is firmly implanted in occult tradition. I personally feel this case involved an impersonator, carefully made up to resemble Jim, with the rather glaring mistake of wearing a top coat in summer. Much evidence points to Mosley having a double, or that a person of the New York area looks very much like him. When I appeared with him on the Long John Nebel versus show early in the spring of that year, John chided Jim for not speaking to him when he encountered him in a passing taxi cab. He told Jim he had rolled down the window and spoken to him, and that he, Jim, had looked him directly in the eye, but had apparently not recognized him at all. Jim had been on various Long John radio shows many, many times, and surely would recognize John. Jim told John he had no memory of the encounter, and apologized for not speaking, although he could not possibly imagine how he could fail to recognize the famous radio personality. Smythe's dog behaved similarly to Bandit, the dog belonging to Newell Partridge, of West Virginia, who complained the animal might have been kidnapped by Mothman, in November, 1966. He said the dog howled like a wolf prior to his seeing two glowing eyes near his barn. Men in Black were also connected with the Mothman sightings. Readers may also remember that Albert K. Bender, who first publicized the three men, suffered painful headaches, see Flying Saucers and the Three Men, published by Paperback Library, Incorporated. The problem of unidentified flying objects. There has been a new theory advanced to explain a and not explain a why are the more mysterious elements and behavior patterns of the flying saucers. Much of the speculation on this theory came from Alan Greenfield, of Atlanta, Georgia, one of the principal proponents of the alternate reality theory. When first advanced in the 1960s, the theory caused a spark of speculation among many saucer researchers as to the actual origin of many of the objects reportedly observed. Although now retired from UFO research, Greenfield met with us in the days of his heavy UFO involvement. On one such occasion, we sat him down to sound him out on his theory. Our first question was an expected one: what actually is the alternate reality theory? Maybe it's just another theory, like so many others, hoaxes, psychological solutions, natural phenomena, spaceships, 4D or whatever. But I think we just may have hit upon something of significance, as I suspect my colleagues in this theory will agree. Mr. Greenfield went on to explain that if his theory turns out to be valid, we are dealing with awesome implications which are really tremendous. It will alter our entire concept of human history. Indeed, it may well alter our very way of living. Greenfield continued by making the following 6 points. 1. The UFO phenomena and other border phenomena seem to be, at least in some cases, linked. 2. Many of the accounts of contact or near contact seem to be true to the extent that they are reasonably accurate subjective accounts of actual experiences of one kind or another. However, there are indications that these experiences, while accurate so far as the witness is concerned, and while having objective external stimuli, are viewed within the context of the observer's own background experience. Also, there is the distinct possibility that some amount of willful deception may be involved on the part of the UFOnauts. 3. The concept of they walk among us is not only not far-fetched, but is probably quite true. This may serve to explain a number of baffling cases that have shown up over the years. 4. We seem to be dealing with groups of entities with more than one purpose. In other words, some sources may well be hostile, some unconcerned, some friendly in one sense or another. 5. The work of such persons as Tom Cornelia, Peter Kaur, the late Ray Palmer, Steve Erdman, Jerome Clark, Paul Thomas and others are particularly important to understanding this theory. 6. Other works, outside the direct usual UFO sphere, are also relevant. Greenfield then pointed out that the fall 1966 issue of Saucer News, edited by James W. Mosley, had an article which should be of interest to anyone engaged in our studies. The article, Perspective, Flying Saucers Are Physical or Psychic, is by Peter Kaur. In this article, Kaur poses three possible frameworks of explanation for the saucer phenomena: 1. Psychic, 2. Conventionally physical, 3. Substratic, intangible. Each of these frameworks has unique consequences, Kaur points out, which can be tested by fundamental trends in the saucer evidence. Which one do you think best fits the history and facts of the flying saucer saga? While the degree of Greenfield's agreement with Kaur's alternatives is tenuous, in his own words, he did find much of what Kaur had to say of interest. Here we apparently have a new term introduced to the field, substratic. Let's not make a mistake, substratic is not the same as alternate realities. It seems to mean a UFO phenomenon that is inherently tangible. It would be interesting to hear how, within this framework, Mr. Kaur accounts for cases of physical evidence. At about the time interest in Greenfield's comments on the R theory had attracted a number of inner circle researchers in the New York area, who had gathered mainly for the purpose of discussing plans for the 1967 Congress of Scientific Ufologists. Mr. Greenfield continued by stating that another article can be gleaned from the July-August, 1966 issue of the outstanding British journal, Flying Saucer Review. The article by Jerome Clark, The Strange Case of the 1897 Airship, poses a very basic question about the nature of UFO and contact accounts. Are they accurate to the extent that the witnesses are reporting what they have seen within the witnesses' own ecological framework? If the answer is affirmative, the implications are quite vast. The following series of informal questions concern, generally, the R theory, and were asked of Mr. Greenfield over the course of many deep conversations on the subject. In relation to the so-called interplanetary theory of saucers, what does the R theory have to offer? As you know, there are inconsistencies in the interplanetary theory, that is, in relation to the evidence. The R theory does not rule out the possibility of interplanetary visitations, but rather says that this may be only a part of the explanation for the phenomena observed. Pure physical phenomena might explain some of the evidence submitted, but there is a large body of evidence that it does not explain. Similarly, a wholly non-physical phenomenon would not explain all the evidence. The R theory seeks to coordinate all the evidence into a single coherent pattern. How then, Mr. Greenfield, does the R theory account for saucers, per se? At this point, a theory does not offer a definite reason for UFOs. There does not seem to be the idea that they are vehicles of a sort, though their exact nature and reason for existence is unsure. There is also the matter of the sub-theory of seeing the phenomenon as a manifestation of the viewer's own background experience, that is, as subjective viewing of an objective stimulus, the exact nature of which is currently unknown. Does the R theory account for mysterious disappearances? Yes, if one accepts the idea that reality is not fixed, at least not fixed in our present understanding of reality, it is not difficult to understand how persons or objects might be caught in some sort of reality warp and enter or leave a given state of reality. This would serve to explain many legends and Fortean phenomena as well. In relation to the above answer, we pointed out to Mr. Greenfield that many sightings are made by more than one person, each of at least a slightly different background, yet their descriptions normally coincide to a large extent. His reply was well thought out. Firstly, persons coming from the same general ecological framework would probably see a given UFO in generally the same way. Secondly, there are cases where persons of totally different backgrounds cite unidentified aerial phenomena, example, the Reverend Gill incident. Further study of these special cases would be needed before a full evaluation of this consideration may be given. Just what then are the mechanics of interreality travel? At this point we can see several trends in the evidence. First, if UFOs are indeed in some way manifestations of vehicular activity, then it would follow that some form of vehicular interreality transmission is possible. Secondly, we have the above-mentioned matter of reality warps. Thirdly, there are the indications of fixed transfer points, such as the holes at the poles Ray Palmer often mentioned. Another question which came to our mind was, why do some UFOs appear hostile, and others not? In our opinion, some UFOs appear to be hostile, some do not, and others appear to be indifferent. Using reasoned speculation, one may assume from this that we are dealing with at least three different groups of entities. This seems consistent with the Shaverian concept of Duro, Tro and Elder races. It is also consistent with our own experience in that there do seem to be three possible basic points of view on a given question, pro, anti, and neutral. We then asked Alan Greenfield how he might approach the various contact cases in light of his theory. The alternate reality can shed a whole new light on cases of alleged contact with alien entities. The idea that contactees have been honestly reporting things as they see them is not new. Dr. Leon Davidson some years ago posed this idea in relation to Adamski's case, but attributed the deception to the government. The flaw in this is the widespread nature of these cases, and the lack of real motivation. However, the R theory can provide a much more plausible rational explanation. For example, if we accept the ecological premise, we can easily see how a contactee, having a legitimate experience, will hear from the space people what he wants to hear. We can also see why persons from more sophisticated backgrounds might have less sophisticated experiences. The problem of deliberate deception can be dealt with in either of the following ways: an individual chances upon a landed UFO. The entities aboard are not welcoming company, so they tell the unfortunate passerby some cock and bull story and send the poor devil on his way. The other instance would be the planting of deliberately contradictory stories with various contactees in order to keep a state of confusion about their nature in effect. Either of these instances are plausible. The men in black type cases might have connections in the same vein. Here there might also be an authentic element of knowing too much about flying saucers, although at least in the famed Bender case, it hardly seems possible that Bender knew all that much. In fact, from his magazine of the period, one would be inclined to say that Bender seemed to know very little about UFOs. UFO witness abducted by agents of terror are the men in black strike once more. We will not reveal to you in what eastern city Patricia Hyde currently resides. The cracking in her voice as she tells her tale of personal terror is sufficient reason for us to believe that the last few years have been a living hell for this young woman. For Patricia is the first to admit that it took her quite a long time before she was able to go about her everyday business without looking over her shoulder at every little sound, paranoid that some Eonia or something or was keeping tabs on her movements. Before July 1972, Pat Hyde hadn't thought much about UFOs. Sure, she had read articles in the popular press, however, still in her early 20s, she had more pressing matters on her mind. But on the humid summer evening when it all began, Pat was to have her consciousness altered and at the same time leave herself open for harassment by the sinister men in black, whose sole purpose seems to be to silence for good those individuals who have had close encounters with otherworldly intelligence and are not bashful about keeping their experience a secret.